pig is also an essentially impure animal.
Yes.
The blood of menses, the blood of the blood of post-natal bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
These are the filthiest, you know, types of blood.
Yes.
You know, and you cannot pray with these types of blood.
Yes.
No matter how much the quantity of the blood of menses or mm-hmm. the blood of pork,
yes.
or the blood of a dog. So even if it is smaller than the size of a thumb, it is one of the invalidating agents,
mm-hmm.
and you cannot pray with it.
What about menstrual blood? Does that?
Yeah, it's also impure. It's also filthy. And you cannot pray with it, even if it's smaller than the size of
a dirham.
A dirham, yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Fajr.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Many people all around the world are trapped with superstitious beliefs which have no positive effects on their lives. One such belief was when the people used to call the prophets as ominous people or signs of unpleasant events. Another example is when two events coincided with each other. If one of such events becomes unfruitful or has negative consequences, the people will lose their trust in the other event too.
Quran mifarmayad wa kull insan alzamnahu ta'irahu fi unuqih.
This is when Allah In the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Isra, Ayah 13 states, "We have attached every person's omen to his neck, and we shall bring it out for him on the day of resurrection as a book that he will find wide open." This means that everyone's destiny is in his own hands, and the deeds of the people will give them either reward or chastisement in the other world. In other words, religion approves what the rational and logical mind approves, and there is no contradiction between the two. In Islamic viewpoint, it is not right to say that bad happenings or negative effects are the results of this and that event, and we free ourselves out of the charges against us. We are responsible for our deeds, and we must leave the superstitious beliefs. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
بل كذبوا بالساعة وأعتدنا لمن كذب بالساعة
They have denied the hour, and we have prepared for those who deny the hour a blaze.
So, as you have been previously with us, dear listeners, in the 9th and 10th verses of this chapter, the Almighty Allah talked about the bounties awaiting the apostle. And these verses somehow answered the previous pretext, false beliefs of the unbelievers. Now, in this verse, the 11th verse, the Almighty Allah somehow mentions the reason, of course, one of the main important reasons why they did such. بَلْ كَذَّبُوا بِالسَّاعَةِ But they denied the hour of resurrection. وَأَعْتَدْنَا لِمَنْ كَذَّبَ بِالسَّاعَةِ سَعِيرًا And we have prepared a blazing fire for him who denies the hour. Let us have a look at the word سَعِير. أَعْتَدْنَا لِمَنْ كَذَّبَ بِالسَّاعَةِ سَعِيرًا A blazing fire translated here. This Arabic word Sa'ir means a burning and a blaze fire. The source of pagans' pretexts most of the time is because of their disbelief in hereafter. Now, to continue the Quranic discussion of pagans' deviation from monotheism and prophethood, which was in the previous verses, this noble verse talks about another part of their deviations from the view of the issue of resurrection. In fact, with the statement of this part, it becomes somehow clear that the pagans were utterly shaky and deviated in all principles of religion. They did not believe in monotheism, they did not believe in prophethood, and they denied resurrection.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Now, two of these points were mentioned in the former verses, and now we turn to the third one. This verse says, بَلْ كَذَّبُوا بِالسَّاعَةِ But they deny the hour of resurrection. By mentioning the Arabic word bel in the beginning of the verse, this verse somehow implies that what they say about monotheism and prophethood is just some pretext that originate from the denial of resurrection. Because if you believe in such a great court, if you believe that divine reward and punishment system is true, you would neither boldly ridicule the truths, nor you would reject a prophet's call for elusive reasons. And most important of all, you wouldn't bow down before the idols that have been created by the human beings themselves. But here, The Holy Quran has not given them any argumentative answer, because they were not men of reason and argument. They had closed their eyes and ears. They have been headstrong. So the Holy Quran warns them. The Holy Quran threatens them severely and harshly, and somehow illustrates their gloomy and painful future in hereafter. Sometimes it seems this logic is more effective for such people. So it's not such that you will find always these logical arguments useful for all kinds of people. Sometimes the people don't want to hear the truth. They are intentionally deviating their paths from the path of hearing reason and argument. So in this case, it's time for warning and threatening. The Holy Quran continues saying, وَأَعْتَدْنَا لِمَنْ كَذَّبَ بِالسَّاعَةِ سَعِيرًا, and we have prepared a blazing fire for him who denies the hour. By this verse, it becomes clear that most of the time when you do not see the people following the orders of the Almighty Allah, when you do not see the people hearing the truth and intentionally deviating their paths from logic and argument, this can be the main reason: denial of the hour of resurrection. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are presently discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. This Charter of Islamic Governance is something that Imam Ali alayhi salam had with him throughout his life, and it was the software which was actually the reason behind him that actually manifested itself in his day-to-day activities in terms of his governance. Of course, we are just able to understand parts of it through his statements, and the greater parts of it probably will not be able to be understood until, inshallah, they themselves teach us, or through very, very, very stringent research and hard work and purification of the soul. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in sermon number 16, explains about his strategy in governance. And in the strategy of governance, he first comes and gives, and so of course this sermon number 16 is talking about his sermon he gave in Medina after coming to power. And there he explains that there is one thing, and that is that Imam Ali alayhi salam himself was aware of the laws of the universe, of the laws of the social interactions and the social fabric of the universe and of the society, and therefore he was in the best position to bring about an Islamic political system and present it towards the people.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam tells us about the fact that he is aware of certain realities of the universe. And this awareness of his regarding the realities of the universe, regarding the way the society works, regarding the nature of a society and the laws of the society, the divine laws that govern the essence of a society, this is what makes him the best person to be able to come and provide a political system to guide the society. And that is what we call a true political system. Why? Because it conforms with the realities at hand. And that is why he says, إِلَّا مَنْ صَرَّحَتْ لَهُ الْعِبَرُ أَمَّا بَيْنَ يَدَيْهِ مِنَ الْمَثُلَاتِ حَجَزَتْهُ التَّقْوَى أَنْ تَقَهُمِ الشُّبُهَاتِ. He says that he gives one law, he presents one law in the nature of a society. And he says that if a person looks at history and takes lessons from it, إِلَّا مَنْ صَرَّحَتْ لَهُ الْعِبَرُ, for one who takes lessons from issues that happened in the society in the past regarding the punishments and rewards that societies got in the past, when he sees the progress and the regress of nations, how they grew and how they fell, how they advanced and how they deteriorated, and if he does that, he will definitely achieve taqwa. He will definitely achieve and will be equipped with a tool that will stop him from getting confused in situations in the society. He will not be engulfed with doubts regarding what to do in the society. This, he gives the nature a law here, a law of the society. This is because he's aware of the laws of the nature, the laws of how society works. And that is why the political system that he is ready to offer will be something that is definitely very powerful and very effective.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
And of course, all the religions of the world, one of their most important duties is to be able to give that analysis, to be able to promote an analysis regarding the events of the past. Why? Because the religions, the divine and the true religions, bear this recognition that when people in a society contemplate about what happened in the past, they have this feeling and this tendency within them to be able to refer to events in the past, the progresses of nations in the past, the destruction of nations in the past. When they have this attitude of studying history and looking at what were the causes of growth and the causes of destruction and deterioration, this is going to strengthen these people, the people, to achieve a certain level of protection against doubtful situations. And this is what we call taqwa. Taqwa is not only something that is that people think that it means staying in the mosque and taking a tasbih and just reciting. No, it is to be able to have this ability to analyze history and be able to apply that analytical understanding in the present day situations. As such, if a person has this ability, then he will never be engulfed by doubts in what steps to take in his day-to-day life in different social circumstances. And Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions this social issue, this social law to the people, kind of encouraging them to take this step, to contemplate about things in the past, so that they make the right decision for the society in the future and now as he becomes the leader. He is encouraging them. He's telling them, now this is the time to take these things into consideration, so that when I, as Imam Ali alayhi salam, take you through this journey of Islamic governance and I bring about these laws and take these steps, then you should be able to not get confused in those situations and be together with your leader. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to always give us the ability to be together with our leaders, our true leaders. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى وفي المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Communicate. We'll be right back.
It's been 2 years now since the United States assassinated General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Both these men were known as formidable tacticians and military commanders, but also revered as national heroes in Iran, Iraq, and the region at large. General Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian general who headed the Quds Force, a branch of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC. Meanwhile, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, an Iraqi, headed Kataib Hezbollah and was the deputy commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, known in English as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU. Both these men played a significant role in defeating al-Qaeda and ISIS, or Daesh, in Syria and Iraq. They formed an integral part of the axis of resistance and were instrumental in Iran's larger support for resistance movements in West Asia, including the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah. I wanted to ask the following questions. What did the work carried out by Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis mean for the region? How have things changed since their murder? And did the Americans succeed in their goal of weakening the axis of resistance? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On January 3rd, 2020, a commercial flight arriving from Damascus landed in Baghdad Airport. Aboard the plane was General Qasem Soleimani, who had come on an official visit at the invitation of the then Iraqi Prime Minister. General Soleimani was met by Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Meanwhile, circling overhead were a number of American aircraft. As Soleimani's convoy was leaving the airport, a Reaper drone fired on them, killing Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, along with four members of the IRGC and four members of the PMU. The shock of this incident was immediately apparent. Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, described Trump's assassination of Soleimani as the equivalent of the Iranians killing the U.S. Defense Secretary.
As to how to manage the fallout that comes from such a drastic action, this is the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the U.S. Secretary of Defense. If the Iranians were to assassinate the U.S. Secretary of Defense, we would consider that an act of war, and we would respond disproportionately.
Trump knew full well that Iran would respond. How could they not? After all, Soleimani was one of the most important and powerful men in Iran, if not the entire region. The day after the assassination, Trump went on an all-caps tirade on Twitter, saying that if Iran responded, they would be hit, quote, very fast and very hard. He also threatened to bomb Iran's cultural sites, a war crime under international law. No U.S. president before Trump had dared to kill General Soleimani, knowing full well that it would be unjustifiable and could easily lead to war. Soleimani's body was brought to Iran to begin the funeral processions and national mourning. In multiple cities, literally millions of people flocked to the streets to mourn the slain commander. Just take a look at these clips from the funeral processions. General Qasem Soleimani was buried on January 7th in his hometown Kerman. After his burial had to be postponed twice because of how large the crowds were, a testament to his popularity. On January 8th, Iran began Operation Martyr Soleimani. In response to the assassination, Iran sent a barrage of rockets, firing a dozen ballistic missiles at the Ayn al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. This base housed foreign troops, mainly Americans, and is located in Iraq, west of Baghdad. This volley of rockets leveled the base. There were no fatalities, however, it said that scores of U.S. troops were injured, many diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. Now, the framing of this attack is again very funny, because in the mainstream media, they were asking if Iran was ready to de-escalate the situation, as if Iran had just assassinated a U.S. official. And also saying things like, well, Iran is lucky. They're lucky they didn't kill any U.S. troops when they launched those missiles. Otherwise, we would have responded. Well, no, Iran didn't just randomly decide to launch missiles at the Ayn al-Assad airbase for no reason or because they don't like your clothes or your hair. They launched the missiles at Ayn al-Assad because you just committed an act of war and murdered an Iranian government official. It is, in fact, the United States who is lucky that Iran didn't do more. Now, the legality of such a strike has been at the center of debate about Soleimani's killing. Donald Trump claimed that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against Americans. Then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that killing Soleimani, quote, saved American lives.
It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work, and the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
It's probably a good time to mention that Mike Pompeo was also the former director of the CIA, where he also did this.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
Neither Trump nor Pompeo could provide any evidence to substantiate their claims about Soleimani. At first, they said that there was an imminent threat, but couldn't give a timeline when. They said days or weeks. Then Pompeo said that they had killed Soleimani because of something that happened in the days before the strike. But those are two completely different things. Something cannot be imminent if it's in the past. And it's not hard to see that Pompeo and Trump are lying and had no evidence of any so-called imminent threat. It seems the only reason Trump and Pompeo made this ridiculous claim about self-defense is because it's the only way Trump could legally justify the assassination at home under U.S. law. In 1973, the War Powers Resolution was passed, requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking military action. In the Trump administration's legal rationale for assassinating Soleimani, they cited the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2002, also known as the AUMF of 2002, which was passed under the Bush presidency for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is one of the most extreme, exaggerated interpretations of the AUMF 2002, which, by the way, was authorized against Iraq, not Iran. And nevertheless, that's just U.S. law, not international law. So just because Trump cites the AUMF of 2002, that doesn't suddenly make it okay on the world stage. Remember, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression and is considered illegal under international law. Trump also claimed that, quote, "The strike against Soleimani in Iraq was taken in the United States' national self-defense, as recognized in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, in response to a series of escalating armed attacks that Iran and Iran-supported militias had already conducted against the United States." Well, speaking of the United Nations disagrees. Agnès Callamard is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, and arbitrary killings. She concluded the U.S. murder of General Soleimani to be unlawful and illegal under international law. In July 2020, the Special Rapporteur published a report in which she examined the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. She rejected the United States' attempts to justify his murder. She found the U.S. to be in violation of the U.N. Charter and that, quote, "the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful." Article 2.4 of the U.N. Charter forbids the use of force by one U.N. member state against another. She concluded that the United States broke this law. The examples of imminent threats provided by the U.S. were in fact not imminent, but things that had already happened months before. Some of them were not even actual attacks, but rather perceived threats, while other examples included things like Iran shooting down a U.S. drone that had illegally entered Iranian airspace. Sina Rahmani is a translator, scholar, and writer. His work has appeared in Iranian Studies, Radical History Review, and Public Books, among others. He's also the creator of the East is a podcast that takes a critical look at the history of the present in West Asia and North Africa. I asked him what he thought the motivations were behind the United States assassination of General Soleimani.
So two men represented and were, in addition to their own work as military commanders, effective ambassadors for their cause and their alliances, movers in their own political environments, and sort of the military aspect, and those aspects of their personality, they both were symbols of a resistance to the U.S. imperial agenda in the region that's been unfolding for three decades in different ways and in different backdrops. But they were the symbol of an alliance between certain forces in the region. They named themselves the Axis of Resistance, but whatever name you give to themselves, it's really just a anti-colonial sort of resistance front or anti-imperial resistance front. So that's the kind of general answer. But in reality, I think there are the sort of cold political calculations. I think that at the time we were in the midst of this kind of unfolding crisis, generated essentially at the behest of a highly placed source of individuals who more or less purchased foreign policy, and that was the sort of signature effect of the Trump presidency, is that he was honest in a way. The Saudis and certain factions among Zionists sort of hedged their bets, and they invested in this guy. And that paid off in that unfolding crisis in those 2 years. And this was, I don't want to say culmination, but in effect, the most dramatic sort of theater of that unfolding drama that was ultimately begun by Washington, begun in those sort of like secret, you know, and unfolded under the course of those 2 years and resulted in the assassination of these two men. Extrajudicial killing, you know. It was totally illegal, and I mean, that's obvious.
I mean, we mentioned these cold, calculated foreign policy decisions. On that front, what was the goal? Why were the Americans trying to assassinate Soleimani and Abu Mehdi in terms of foreign policy objectives? And did they succeed? You know, if their goal was to change the Middle East, do you believe that they succeeded in that? And how do you think their deaths have affected the region?
In the sense of, like, you know, cold, hard calculations, nothing changes. I mean, nothing changes in the real. There are these two men played historic roles, yes, but ultimately they were reflections of a system of resistance that's been in production for a long time. And those systems have been tested in the last two decades of cataclysmic war being waged from all corners of the entire sort of West Asian region. And the Iranians emerged. There's a historic development in the last two decades. You know, this has been my adult life, is watching the U.S. empire make this insane, you know, like cataclysmic leap, you know, of ridiculous proportions of its trying to establish its, like, you know, insane goals of regime change. You know, what was it, 7 countries in 5 years or 5 countries in 7 years? The General Wesley Clark thing. This is one chapter in a larger story of unceasing war fought by the U.S. against Iran, against its allies, and against anyone who doesn't want to go about being, taking its place in the supply chain, which is what it wants from ultimately the entire region, right?
Yeah, so I mean, basically the resistance goes on because it's a whole system of, countering colonialism, imperialism.
I mean, at a certain point, 40% of the U.S. military was surrounding Iran. I mean, think of that. That was the first phase. And then the second phase came, their mercenaries, for the, you know, which their first class one was ISIS, and then the rest of their allies, their supposed allies. And it was just like this team that rocked up and spent the last 10 years destroying the countries that they hadn't destroyed. And the response to that was what Qasem Soleimani's legacy, and we undercut the value of Abu Mohandes, right? We should obviously sort of talk about that. But like both of these men and the forces that they represented and the alliances they represented and what they were, you know, leading members of, but ultimately were part of a larger sort of organism, that represented something historic. That's on the scale of the Spanish Civil War, where you had this fascist transnational alliance, except it was bigger than one country. And the response to it was a popular mobilization of normal people taking up weapons. And that's the legacy of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, in the popular mobilization units, which were not a creation of Iran. It was, in fact, a creation of Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, right? That was Ali Sistani. So there's a lot of silliness when it comes to talking about Iran, and one of the worst things is this totally racist and totally bankrupt Orientalist thing of Iranians are the only ones who control things and the rest are their puppets. I mean, it's like Cold War stuff reinvented.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So we know the excuses provided by the U.S. are not true. The United Nations and a large part of the world reject them. So why did the United States assassinate General Soleimani? The murder of Haj Qasem was part of a string of American hostilities against Iran. Trump quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Then he reimposed sanctions on Iran, crippling its economy, flying drones and bombers into Iranian airspace. Trump and Pompeo claimed that Soleimani endangered American lives. No, he didn't. America endangered its own troops' lives, never mind the people of Iraq, Syria, and others, by invading countries on the other side of the planet. This is not your turf. No one endangers American lives in the Middle East except America. You cannot invade foreign countries and then expect people to just shut up and tolerate being occupied. It's also quite amusing listening to the Western media try to explain who Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was. They say that he fought against American interests in Iraq, as if the Americans have any business being there in the first place after they invaded and occupied the country. That's like if you're talking about the French resistance in World War II and you say that the French resistance is opposing German interests in France. That's a very funny way to say that someone is resisting a foreign military occupation. Now, the United States claims that Soleimani was a terrorist, but Soleimani was killing terrorists, specifically the ones in Syria, funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and their allies. Soleimani's role in the region was an undeniably important one. Most generals today, whether in Iran or the United States, are unheard of. Most Americans probably have no idea who General Petraeus is, and he's one of the more known military leaders in the U.S. In Iran, with General Soleimani, it's a completely different story. He's a national hero and was known as being charismatic and a general who led from the battlefield, not a desk general who sat comfortably away from the front. The Americans love to pretend that they care about minorities. They pretend to care for the Christians in Iraq and Syria. When Mike Pompeo spoke in Occupy Jerusalem, he claimed that General Soleimani was responsible for killing thousands of Christians across the Middle East. This is one of the biggest lies that has ever come out of Mike Pompeo's mouth, which is really saying something.
Qasem Soleimani. This is the man most responsible for the murder and maiming of hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Christians across the Middle East.
Neither Soleimani nor Iran has ever killed or targeted Christians in the Middle East. On the contrary, Christians who come from the Middle East, like myself, owe a huge debt of gratitude to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi because these men and their troops are the ones who protected Christians from being killed by Daesh. Meanwhile, it is the United States and Israel and people like Mike Pompeo who were funding Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra and terrorist groups like that, which purposely targeted religious minorities. This is why when Haj Qasem was assassinated, Arab churches in the region held mass for Soleimani and Christians prayed for him. Soleimani is not only dear to the Iranians, but to all the people of West Asia and the Levant who understood the role that he played in fighting the imperialists and their proxies in the region. Dr. Fuad Izadi is an associate professor of American studies at the University of Tehran. His work focuses on United States-Iran relations and U.S. public diplomacy. Izadi has also appeared as a political commentator on various international media outlets such as RT, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. I asked him about the important work General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi carried out in protecting minorities in the Middle East. Well, one thing that isn't really talked about enough is that Haj Qasem, Abu Mahdi, they really helped to protect minorities in the Middle East. Christians, Muslims, you know, everyone alike realized the important role that they played. Even after his death, after Soleimani's death, we saw Christians holding mass for him in churches, praying for Haj Qasem. I mean, isn't that a powerful example, a powerful testament to his defense of all kinds of ethnic groups and religions living in this region, defending them from terrorism and imperialism?
You know, this is something that the Western corporate media has generally censored. The fact that Christians in Syria, the Christians in Iraq, were under attack by ISIS unjustly. Islam does not teach its followers to kill Christians. That's not part of Islamic teaching. And realizing that fact, it was actually Qasem Soleimani that was defending the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, no matter what religion was. And it was very much true, as you said, that after his assassination, Christians in this part of the world lost someone who was helping them survive attacks by people who claimed to be Muslim, but they were not really following the teachings of Islam. And this very fact is hardly see any coverage of that very fact, because Qasem Soleimani was supposed to be a terrorist. cannot have a terrorist defending Christian. That's not going to be the frame that Western news media outlet want to present. So there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to how the media coverage in this part of the world is actually done. It was Qasem Soleimani that highlighted this hypocrisy throughout his life.
You know, one of the things the United States likes to take credit for is supposedly defeating Daesh. Even until now, they claim that they're in Iraq because they're fighting Daesh. Realistically speaking, does the credit go to the Americans or does it go to Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? Because a lot of people seem to think that they should take the credit for helping to bring the downfall of Daesh. Do you agree that they had a much more significant role in combating all these foreign fighters, the terrorist groups backed by NATO and the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf?
Who was fighting terrorism? Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. We have numerous accounts of the U.S. actually helping ISIS directly or indirectly. This is something that even some Western sources wrote after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that the United States assassinated the most important individual in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. talked about fighting ISIS. In a lot of cases, they actually helped ISIS. And the country that fought ISIS, the military commander that engaged in that was Qasem Soleimani. But that's, if somebody's interested in fighting terrorism, somebody's interested in establishing peace, they should look at Qasem Soleimani as a hero.
So in the last weeks, we've seen reports that the Israelis were involved in the attack, or at least they've admitted to being involved in the attack. Trump allegedly said that he felt used by the Israelis. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that assessment that the Israelis used him? And what do you make of the Israeli role in the murder of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi?
You know, we had a retired Israeli general that just a few days ago said that Israel is doing well. And we had other accounts that actually pointed out that Qasem Soleimani was someone that not only fought against U.S. domination, and overall, you have a situation where Israelis are not actually in a better shape today when you compare their standing now to what happened to when Qasem Soleimani was alive. You remember just a few months ago, we had the resistance in Gaza, in Palestine, actually fighting back.
In the Middle East, General Soleimani is considered a hero because he defeated terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In the West, they call him a terrorist because he defeated their proxies, Daesh and Al-Qaeda. If the goal of the assassination was to cripple Iran or hurt Iran's military capabilities, that has obviously failed. Iran is stronger than it was 2 years ago by all reasonable metrics. Look how its military capability has grown and how the regional makeup has shifted in its favor. The United States had to flee Afghanistan. It can no longer sustain its occupation of Iraq. Its war against Syria has failed. If the goal was to demoralize the axis of resistance, that has also failed. The Houthis in Yemen are making huge advances as Saudi Arabia realizes it can no longer sustain this war against them. In Iraq, Soleimani's assassination prompted the Iraqi parliament to vote to tell the Americans to leave. And the Hashd al-Shaabi have become an even stronger force in Iraq, keeping the U.S. occupation on its toes. And while sanctions in Syria continue to take a strong toll, the project for regime change has failed and looks weaker and weaker by the day as Arab countries begin normalizing ties again with Syria. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has brought in fuel and helped to mitigate the effects of the de facto American siege with the help of Iran. And finally, Iran itself is in an even stronger position than it was before. It has more leverage in its nuclear program, a stronger relationship with China and Russia, and deeper ties with its neighboring countries. So by killing Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, did the United States succeed in weakening Iran or weakening the axis of resistance? The answer is clearly no. Iran and the resistance axis, they don't function like the USA or some random country. You cannot just kill one man, one leader, and then think, oh, everything is over. Now, while General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were certainly formidable tacticians and commanders in their own right. Together, they formed part of a system, part of the resistance. And you cannot defeat the resistance by simply killing one or two important individuals. Haj Qasim and Abu Mahdi played a crucial role. This is undeniable. But the objectives of resisting against occupation, imperialism, and neocolonialism continue. And this is something that will only end with the complete liberation of the Middle East and Palestine. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life. A complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. I'm Hassanain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza al-Miyaqum. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Brother Miqdad, in the previous shows, one of our listeners had written to us a question that a few months ago, my brother and his family went to Ziyarah in the Middle East, Iran and Iraq. And when they came back, their children, who are the same age as my children, had different things that were from an Islamic culture, like rings, dishosha, and different types of tasbih, etc. And my children obviously want the same. On one aspect, I understand the importance. However, living in the West, it's very much against the local culture. So I'm a bit worried about this. What do you suggest me to do? So Brother Miqdad, we were discussing about different cultures and how we can follow the different types of cultures with respect to the Islamic principles. So please, if you'd like to add any more points to it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the previous show, we talked about this relationship between culture and Islamic guidelines. And we said that Islam as such, you wouldn't say that Islam has a culture. Rather, mm-hmm. Islam gives guidelines to different cultures. And
true.
In whatever culture thing they do, Islam brings about principles and red lines and uh-huh. limitations or additions, basically, to ensure that the human being, through their own culture, mm-hmm. through their own language and yeah. the way they do things, are able to reach their perfection, which mm-hmm. is the servitude of Allah. And we also said that we have to be careful, though. A lot of the cultures have, because culture at the end reflects an ideology, reflects a values and principles. So we have to understand that certain ideologies, certain cultures reflect an ideology that's completely true. Against Islam, mm-hmm. right?
Is it right if you say that we can follow any culture, like keeping the Islamic boundaries in our mind?
So it's a very good question. What you'll realize is that certain cultures, you'll be very far from them, or it'll be very difficult to adapt them, uh-huh. okay, if you try and implement what Islam says.
Yeah.
Take the Western culture, for uh-huh. example. It's very difficult to completely be a Western, have a culture that's completely Western, okay,
mm-hmm. yeah.
by abiding by Islamic values and principles, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Western culture, for example, is about drinking
yeah.
alcohol, right?
Yeah.
You go to the pub every weekend.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's about interacting with men and women in a very free way.
So over here, there's nothing like the Islamic boundaries. It's completely against the Islam.
It's very difficult to completely adopt the Western culture, for sure.
Yeah.
Right? Like, for example, you'd say the Arab culture or the Iranian culture or Western culture, for example, you would say they're closer to